Radio Times. I'm Artie Moskowain. Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and looks at 500 submissions every week. Only a handful will make it into the magazine. Many years ago, he was one of those aspiring cartoonists determined to be published in The New Yorker and finally was on June 20th, 1977. Mankoff has written a memoir illustrated with New Yorker cartoons with a title taken from the caption of one of his most famous, "How about never? Is never good for you?" He writes that his mother was an early target for his jokes. She was an anxious and obsessive parent, and Mankoff believes that humor needs conflict to thrive. Bob Mankoff joins us on Radio Times to talk about his life, his approach to cartoons, and his years at The New Yorker, and it's a great pleasure. I laughed all yesterday afternoon. Bob Mankoff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm really pleased to be here, and I hope you'll be laughing after the interview
we will find out at 12 o'clock today.
Right.
This is a great cartoon. This businessman is on the phone. He's got his calendar open, and he starts, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" That phrase has lived on. Why do you think?
I think it lives on because, we're a species in constant conflict with the things we want and the things we must do. And what that I think I did that in 1993, and now it's in the Yale Book of
it's
Quotations,
everywhere.
Right?
Yes.
Right next to Mao Zedong and other famous humorists. And, it does what humor does. It's sort of a mashup. The mashup is that the message is rude, but the language is polite. And that's why the little tag end you need at the end. You don't stop it in "No Thursday's out, how about never?" You could stop it there. It would still be a joke. You say, "It's never good for you." So it's, even though you're being incredibly rude, you're still being right as though you care.
Well, and when I scribbled in my notes here, I put friendly and hostile.
Right. Friendly and hostile. And as I remarked about Yiddish, the language my mother would insult me with, it also is a funny language that way also because it's sort of it's funny in itself, in its words, schlemiel, schlemazel. Even when my mother called a schlemazel versus a schmegegi, these fine distinctions, all distinctions of people who aren't quite living up to what they should. And when my mother would sometimes she just called me Kleinahent, which is like little dog. Then I got older, she called me Grosse Pferd, which is big horse. All sort of loving, but obviously a big horse or a little dog is not so good. The thing she always called me was a nervous chalaria. Now, that's Yiddish for nervous is nervous, and chalaria is cholera. I was a nervous plague.
But you had this mother. my jaw dropped there on the radio. Yeah. But you had this mother. I mean, your parents and clearly your mother loved you, but did she love you too much? Did she love you?
She loved
you?
Me to pieces.
Literally.
She loved to pieces. I'd eat you up, and I didn't want to be eaten up. So I think some of the humor came out of, once again, conflict again. The conflict, of course, you love your mother, you're dependent on your mother and everything. At the same time, I needed to push her away. There was a 60 Minutes episode, showed some home movies, and in it, my mother is smooching me. But I'm not smooching back.
Oh, you're not.
I'm going, I think... part of my problem with my early marriage
was your mother.
Well, in those home movies, they didn't show it on 60 Minutes. But there's my first girlfriend Wendy, and we're like 5 or 6. And then Wendy is also smooching me, but I'm going, I'm doing the thing. So my mother was like before a helicopter parent. She was like a drone parent. She was like everywhere, and I say in the book that. And some of my humor comes really directly out of it. My mother had a number of miscarriages, had me rather late in life for
she's
that 37, time.
She was 37,
when she was 37, and then she used to put a mirror up to my mouth to make sure I was breathing when I was a child. And as I say in a joke, and I still do that occasionally just to make sure.
You talk about her, quote, obsessive attention to my existence. Obviously, if you're holding a mirror up.
Right.
But this is a very anxious mother. And a very worried mother about her only child.
Right, and she raised a very anxious son who you know, I once did a cartoon. I mean, the caption, it's guys at a boardroom, and the head guy is saying, well, I don't think there's any need to panic. I think there's need to make preparations to panic. So I am constantly making preparations to panic. Why wait to the last, minute? But all humor comes from difficulties, things that in another context are not good. It's our device actually dealing. I mean, it can't even deal with tragedy, but for the most part, it doesn't deal with tragedy. For the most part, it deals with our overreactive, hyper-aware systems that sense danger everywhere, even though, you know, that everything seems, you know, like a catastrophe. I was coming in today from Westchester, getting to Grand Central. What if I don't make it? What if I don't get to Grand Central? Then your feeling is you will die. But that's
or
not
something
true.
Terrible.
Terrible happened. And it would have been terrible not to miss this delightful interview I'm having. But still, that's how you react. And so humor comes out of that.
But even, and it's interesting the way you write about your mother. I mean, she became this target for your jokes, that you, maybe even a foil for your humor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother, I don't know where it was. Maybe it's the fifth grade. It's the sixth grade where you realize you have this thing, humor, and it can be aggressive, it can be affiliative, but mostly at that point it's aggressive. It's a way really of defending yourself. Right. You know, I say in the book and where I was raised in this, you know, it's not an isolated Jewish environment. It wasn't like I was at a yeshiva, but it was New York in the 50s, and the neighborhoods where I grew up in Queens were divided into a block of Jewish people, a block of Irish people, a block of Italian people, you know, and everyone had their own mechanism. I mean, the Italian guys were nice enough. They beat us up, you know, ritually every once in a while, but nothing like serious. But our preferred weapons were not our fists, but our...
But humor?
Humor, wits. And sometimes that's just insults. And that way I could also push my mother away if she, you know... She said to my father, Lou, he's lazy, he don't do nothing. And I'd say, he don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton. And then, now she wouldn't even know what I was talking about. But she would know that somehow, and then she would say to my father, would you look at the mouth on him?
But maybe lovingly,
loving,
proudly.
Maybe that maybe. But I got a lot from my mother because what my mother had was chutzpah. In other words, she wasn't afraid to open up a mouth, and neither am I, as you can see. And so that was, for an anxious kid, so that was like a hybrid thing that I had. I was anxious, I was worried, but I always was ready to defend myself by talking. So I relate in the book that when I was in college, I was a bad student. I went to Syracuse University. Went to one of these classes where you really didn't have to attend. This was like 1966. I went to the first class to find out what the textbook was. Then I attend the last class, and everyone's always scribbling around their blue books. I go in there, and the professor comes over to me and says, who the hell are you?
All right.
And I said, you know what? I could very well ask you the same question. And the whole class, and all of a sudden the tables had turned. Temporarily, you're still going to fail.
Right.
But
you've got their attention,
But that's a victory. That's a victory. That shows that in a world, even in battles, in a world that other people have the power, you also have the power if also you can look at things not how everybody else is looking at that. And, you know, and I've done that, you know, in life itself and also in cartoons. You know, I actually always like to fool around. Like when I'm in...
Let me ask you something. Only because it's interesting to me that you nearly got a PhD in experimental psychology. So you were this close to having a PhD in psychology.
You put your fingers together like there's a little space. See,
a little space.
I was on the cusp, but the cusp was a very big cusp.
Okay,
it stretched for miles after my experimental animal died from creative and inventive procedures.
But can you imagine what your life had would have been like if you had been an experimental psychology, a psychologist rather?
I do imagine it. Sometimes I wake up at night screaming.
Really? I mean, which is why you said, I can't do this?
No, it was really because it was a time bomb ticking in my head. It wasn't going well. I knew I always wanted to do something in humor.
Oh, you did?
And then when I woke up and I was 30, and so, you know, that's sort of at the, in a way, it's at the end of the 60s, even though it's 1974 and everything. And you really, oh, gee, I'm not going to be young forever. But my brain was on fire with the idea, well, you know what? I have the tremendous advantage of now having failed at psychology, having failed at teaching speed reading to Catholic girls by telling them to read faster or they'd burn in hell.
Is that true?
Yes, by being inept at almost everything and generally a world-class incompetent, except in this one thing that I'm actually good at, which is being funny. And so I was either going to go into stand-up, but there really wasn't that many places to stand-up or cartooning because I'd been to the High School of Music and Art. I talk about that in the book.
Right.
I had some talent in drawing. And, you know, at that point, it was just back to the wall, and my brain was on fire with it, and I just went all at it. And from 19... I sold cartoons almost immediately to Saturday Review and the National Lampoon. It took me 2 years to sell cartoons to the New Yorker. I talk in the book. I submitted thousands to them. But I didn't look back, and I didn't look left, and I didn't look right. I didn't think. I didn't really think about the consequences. What if you failed? This was just... this. I saw the ring on the merry-go-round, and I figured, well, this is what I'm going to do.
But you make an interesting point that when you look at psychologists or psychiatrists and comedians, many of them are Jewish.
Well, many of them certainly were.
I don't know if it's true today.
In 1979 study, 80% of people in professional comedy were Jewish. Now, what happened in a way is I think Jewish culture... Jewish humor, the way of looking at the world, of riffing on it, of look, you know, from combined from just a million experiences in Eastern Europe, in studying the Talmud, in all this logic chopping that the Jews did in looking at the Bible, then being oppressed in Eastern Europe, being divided into three groups, the sort of the Hasidim who were emotional, the Orthodox, and then the assimilationists. Out of that came just this incredible humor culture. Before that, the Bible's not funny, but Jews are. This Jews are to American humor what blacks are to American basketball. That's the truth of it. Now out in front, yeah, there's... Everybody has assimilated that, and they have their own ethnicities, their own background. But in the background, in the writers' rooms, in everything, you're going to find if you look at Jon Stewart's show, you find how many of his writers are Jewish. If you look at Pete Holmes, now I may be wrong about this, but I'll go out on a limb, but I'll say there's an awful lot of Jewish people.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Bob Mankoff. He's cartoon editor of The New Yorker. He's also the author of a new book called How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the real-life computer hacker who designed a lot of the tech you see on the hit series House of Cards.
We wondered all these things that people would be able to recognize. When you zoom in, you can really recognize them, but you can also see that they were still drawn a little prettier than they normally look.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker, author of a memoir called How About Never Is Never Good For You. And that's part of a caption of one of his most famous cartoons. And he has spent almost 20 years at The New Yorker as the editor. And he also had his first New Yorker cartoon accepted and published on June 20th, 1977. And again, taking calls at 888-477-9499. I wonder, though, whether even having this psychology background, even if you were a terrible student and you were this far away from getting your PhD, did it help you, though, as a cartoonist to really understand the kind of foibles and sort of obsessions that people have? Or maybe if you were dealing just with rats,
I was an experimental psychologist in animal behavior, so the rats had very few foibles that I could relate to.
I got
so I do talk about it in the book that one of the things I did investigate at that time was called reinforcement schedules. And I talk about the relation to that in the book, like how you're rewarded. You know, you reward a rat to press the bar. If you reward him all the time, he's happy. Right. But then if you stop, he stops fairly quick. And that eventually, almost accidentally, in submitting cartoons in this sort of random way that they got rewarded by some magazines doing it, I became sort of addicted. It's like in animal behavior, it's called a gambling schedule. So it's the same type of thing that hooks people on gambling. They don't win every time, but if they won, you start them winning, and then gradually you don't. So, you know, that was an effect. Of course, later, you know, in the last 10 years, I've gone back to the psychology of humor, a member of the International Society of Humor Studies, and I've done sort of research using the caption contest. So I'm interested in, and I do in this book, analyzing humor. E.B. White said, analyzing humor is like dissecting a frog. Nobody's much interested, and the frog dies.
Right.
I kill a few, but there's no genocide.
Yeah, exactly. And how did your mother feel about the fact that you were going to give up on this psychology career and work in comedy?
You mean after fainting?
After fainting, yes. And recovering. Getting herself up off the floor.
She didn't understand it. She thought it was a disaster. My father said to me, I relate this in the book, you know, my mother and father were born in 1907 and 1908. So they had been, and that's another world. Over 100 years ago.
Right.
Their formative experiences are really the Depression. Because that's when they're adults, and all of a sudden, the 20s. My father sold newspapers as a kid when people came back from World War I. Okay, so they were the first generation. They looked at if I was going to be a psychologist, I read, not that they actually knew what it was. I mean, they were not stupid people, but they were not educated in this way.
And they were anxious people.
And
my
mom was anxious. My father was not. My father was the opposite. Whatever my mother Molly, whatever hysteria she was going through, she'd say, my father would say, "This too shall pass." So my father actually was a rock. He wasn't anxious. He wasn't anxious at all. But he was a realist, or what he thought was realistic and maybe true. So when I said I wanted to be a cartoonist for The New Yorker, he said, "You know, they already have people who do that." So I said, "Well, look, one of them might die."
That's a good comeback.
I'll scan the obituaries, and then I'll be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. Right. Condolences, but here's why I'm here with my cartoons.
I know someone that wanted to be a psychologist, and his father said to him, "Do you know how much the average psychologist makes?" And he said, "What makes you think I'm going to be average?"
That's a great line.
So they recovered.
They recovered, and not only that, they were supportive. My parents loved me, and so really, no matter what, they used to say. The thing, half belief, but part of it was a kernel of truth. We don't care if you're a garbage man, just so long as you're the best garbage man. And then I said to my mother, "Well, you know, in New York City there are over 12,000 sanitation workers. That's hard to be it'll be easier to be a cartoonist." So they supported me. They actually supported me. They gave me money. They said, "All right, give it a try." And during the 70s, and I was married, but my father gave me $200 a month. He said, "Hey, give it a try."
Wow, that's nice.
So, and that's one of the things I encourage, you know, for people parents who have creative kids, and they're pushing them to, but the kids there's a little bit something unusual about them. Maybe they're not that good at school. Maybe they're good in one thing and not the other. And they have this other talent. You know, I say, you know what, support them. The office will always be there. But when you but support them when they want to do the thing they want to do, and you know, and somebody hopefully listens.
And did they live long enough to know that you became the cartoon editor for the New Yorker?
My mother did. My father died in '96, but he was very proud. Just the fact that I was a cartoonist, that I started the Cartoon Bank, that he was very proud of me. They both were very proud of me. My mother was always a little bit bewildered by what it was I did, and. Would you know, had this way of like bringing you down a bit, saying, "Hey, Mom, you know I'm a cartoon editor now, so they pay you for this?"
Scratching her head.
They pay you? Really? What do you do? I don't know. I wouldn't pay someone for that, you know. And you know, and she never quite understood. Like in the New Yorker, none of the she said, "So you do a drawing and it illustrates the article?" No. So you do a funny joke, but the funny joke relates to something in the magazine? No.
No.
Why do they use it?
Did she ever get it?
I don't think she ever got it, but she was proud of it. She was proud of it. That was enough.
You say about her, and then we'll move on to the rest of your life, that she was what sounded like a lifelong hypochondriac, but she lived into her 90s.
That's right. My mother lived to be 93 in what I call in the book robust ill health.
Yeah, robust ill health.
Robust ill health.
But was she ill?
She always had something. I've always got something. You know, there's always something. I mean, my wife is like Watts. Never go to the doctor. Drink scotch. Forget about it. You know what I mean? It'll pass. Whatever. It's just going to do you harm. You know, and I go to doctors and I cheat on the doctors I go to.
You lie to them?
No, I go to other doctors too that they don't know about. You know what I'm saying?
Because you're sneaking around on your doctors?
Well, I'm a skeptic. I'm sneaking around, you know, okay, you know. And I mean, a lot of the cartoons I do, you know, in the book have to do with I have a book called Modern Medicine, and it says, looks like a paper cut, Bob, but let's do lots of tests just to make sure. So I got that. Right. I got that from her, and the way I deal with it is she didn't deal with humor. She dealt with it by being, you know, constantly worried. And I'm constantly worried, too, but you know what? The byproduct of the worry is jokes, and the jokes actually help me deal with it.
Indeed. And that's Bob Mankoff, again, cartoon editor of The New Yorker, and he's the author of a book. It's a memoir about how he got into cartooning, a bit about his life, and a bit about how cartoons are selected for The New Yorker, and it's called How About Never Is Never Good For You, My Life in Cartoons. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at Marty Moss Coaim. And if there's a cartoon that has stayed with you, do let us know about it. You have a very interesting and very distinctive style. The some have called it pointillist style, but I think that describes it pretty well.
Dots.
Music
and art, I looked at these photographs and I saw, if you look closely at photographs, they're all made of dots, and I used to create faces from the dots. And there was something fascinating to me because there was a randomness as I did it. See that? Hear that sound? That would be the sound of my pen. That's how fast it would be going as I made the dots, and the faces would form. And it was really a way of me sketching, a little bit of me covering up my awkwardness as a draftsman. You know, I could draw, but you know, and then the style just formed, and that's what I tell cartoonists coming in. Style is a process. Style is something that you partly control, but then controls you. And for me also, because the process would take so long, it would put me into this sort of dream state. Mm. And I think you need to be in a sort of trance state to come up with humor. You can't really... your logical mind, if you're just thinking, like a mind for the SAT is the worst mind for humor. Somehow it's got to be a little dreamy, a little loose, a little messy. So doing something else sort of frees up your unconscious to, you know, come up with ideas. I sort of call it dreaming while you're awake.
Yeah. And is it multitasking? Is it having radio on? Is it in terms of just sort of occupying your mind to get into that dream state?
I think actually you get into the dream state when you shut off all the stimulation after you've been stimulated.
Right.
And right. so that your mind starts to create these connections while you're actually being stimulated by ideas, while you're driving in traffic, while you're anxious about coming down on Amtrak, while these things, you're not thinking of jokes. All these though are going into your mind just in the way that dreams call them up again. So you're in a sort of, you constantly move sort of between what I call soft focus, you know, slightly looking away from I looked away from the microphone, which is wrong.
You could hear that, bad, right?
Yeah, slightly looking away from it. And then as you get a little kernel of an idea or a joke, you know, so you say, travel. I just recently did a joke, you know, where I say, travel, what am I concerned about? Travel, okay. I'm concerned about the Wi-Fi, internet.
Oh,
okay,
right.
So then I imagine, okay, you're in Tuscany, or you've come back from Tuscany, and the people ask you how you were, and say, oh, the food was delicious, and the cell reception was great, and the Wi-Fi was to die for. So you sort of mash all those up. But
no,
but they won't actually come usually when you're in Tuscany.
You include some drawings of James Thurber, and I have to say, as a kid growing up, and I was sort of the opposite of living in New York. I lived in Delaware in the
right.
countryside yeah. in the 1950s and 60s, and I just loved his maybe because he used animals, his humor, his cartoons. You describe someone at the New Yorker describing him as a third-rate artist, but obviously he has been an inspiration for you.
Well, no, actually, that I'll just say Howard Ross was the first editor. Someone said Thurber was a fifth-rate artist, right. And he said, no, third-rate.
Third-rate artist.
And another anecdote along those lines is that Thurber had what I call, and he opened up a whole field for good and ill, called good-bad drawing. He couldn't really draw very well. Right. But somehow everything he drew was loose and fine
yeah.
and had an iconography. Well, one day he knew his limitations as an artist, and E.B. White was his friend. Actually, E.B. White inked in his original drawings and sent them to, because Thurber just threw them away. So then after Thurber got published, he started to practice his drawing. E.B. White came to him and said, what are you doing? He said, well, I want to get better. And E.B. White said, don't get any better. If you got any better, you'd be mediocre.
Oh, which is brilliant.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So his drawing inspired me originally because it was so loose, and I actually couldn't, in a technical sense, could draw better than him. So I figured, okay, let me develop my own style. And also, his humor was so loopy. Actually, if you look at his humor, you know, the knock against some New Yorker cartoons, and really most of them aren't like this, is I don't get it. Well, honestly, a lot of Thurber cartoons, if you look back, if people, I'm talking about now, and they don't know it's Thurber, they'd say, really? There's a seal on the headboard, and
yeah,
the woman
exactly.
is saying, having your own way, you heard a seal bark. That's become a classic.
Yes.
But it's not really a bada-bing joke. It isn't. And in fact, the drawing is accidental. He actually was trying to draw
I'm
that seal.
I'm looking at it right now, yeah.
He was actually trying to draw that seal on an ice floe. And then the ice floe looked like a headboard. Eventually, he drew the headboard, and then he did the rest of the cartoon. So everything about his stuff was a little bit spontaneous, extemporaneous, and loopy.
Did I read this right, that in, I guess, the early days of The New Yorker for the cartoons, that one person did the pictures and another person did the captions?
For some, not for Thurber,
okay.
Not for some, but there were gag writers then. Jim Garrity, who was the first art editor, cartoon editor, did most of the captions for Peter Arno. George Price really didn't do any of his ideas. So sometimes there was a combined effort, as I talk about in the book. Over time, that changed when sort of the idea, mainly in the 60s, came out of authenticity. So more and more singers sang their own songs, right? Now, you know, they might do a cover, but almost every singer now is also a singer-songwriter.
True.
And so the cartoonist, William Shawn, I don't think necessarily intentionally, but part of who he was the great editor after Howell Ross, wanted it to be one thing.
Yeah, yeah. And how many submissions did you have before your cartoon was accepted in 1977?
I say 2,000, but it's lots.
Really?
It's lots. Just lots, because I was submitting every week. You know, people say, oh, I have an idea for a cartoon, you know.
Yeah.
When
heard that before, right?
I've heard that before when I was at my cardiologist, one of my visits, of course. You know, and he found out I was cartoon editor of The New Yorker. He stopped all his machines and said, you know, I have an idea for a cartoon.
Yeah.
I said, great, I got an idea for a bypass. But the people think that they have. We don't get one idea. So when I would often submit 20 or 30 ideas at a time, and I was doing everybody else's cartoons, so it took me a while to actually find my particular voice.
Well, and it's hard to describe what got in. Perhaps you've probably done this before, the one that got accepted. I mean, it's a
very
cartoon.
It's a very strange cartoon, but I was very influenced by Saul Steinberg. And so it's a very detailed drawing of an old-fashioned printing press, and with the guy is at the end of the printing press, but it's at his breakfast table. As the whole newspaper comes off, he's reading the paper, and he has a little glass of orange juice and eggs. So I was sort of surprised by it, and my early cartoons were strictly visual.
Yeah.
You know, the next one, there was one where there was a cartoon, a guy opens a medicine cabinet, and all you see is apples. So, you know,
the apple a day, right?
A woman carrying water, but instead of two buckets, there's three, and so it's H, H, and O. So they were very, very cerebral cartoons. And they were very much influenced by European cartooning, by Saul Steinberg. And those cartoons are actually very, I don't do that anymore. Those are like real dream cartoons.
Well, you also have used your various marriages as part of your cartoons.
Yeah.
One is a couple sitting together having dinner, and the guy is saying to her, look, I can't promise I'll change, but I can promise I'll pretend to change.
You have no idea what a huge effort that is for men.
Then there's another one on the next page, two guys talking to each other. They're at an intersection. Women want more these days, Bill. It's not enough to be just a jerk anymore.
That's really those are slow realizations over the course of three marriages that I came. That really, actually, you know, I mean, you probably remember, you know, often it was really enough to be a jerk.
I do remember some people in my life like
right.
that. Another one that I like, and it's two guys in a car getting out of a parking spot, and this one guy is saying, amazing. Three failed marriages, scores of disastrous relationships, many financial reversals, and countless physical ailments, but through it all, I've always had good luck parking.
And that's directly from from my own experience when I was going through a really bad time in the 80s, and all of those things were actually true.
Including the parking space?
But that was like the thing, the silver lining, good parking luck.
You look at about, 500 submissions?
Well, it's about 500 from our regular cartoonists. You know, wow. And about 500, and we look at them eventually, they come in from around the world, from really everybody, amateurs, professionals, nephews, nieces, who are extremely talented, of course.
Of course they are.
And from those 500, I take about 17 to the meet item. 17, that's not true. 17 is what gets, on the average, is what gets in the magazine. I'll take 40 or 50 of those to David Remnick. We meet with Sylvia Killingsworth, the managing editor. So it's me, David, and Sylvia. There are three baskets. No, maybe, and yes.
Wow.
We tried four baskets. It drove us mad.
Really? That was enough?
No. Three is what we use. I show them to David. David actually makes the final decision because he makes the decision on everything. He even paginates the magazine. So, you know, but I sometimes will say, hey, come on, this is really good. And sometimes he'll go with my opinion.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also get some callers in. Bob Mankoff is our guest, cartoon editor of The New Yorker, author of a memoir called How About Never Is Never Good For You? My Life in Cartoons. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Westtown invites families to their 650-acre campus for three spring events, an activity-filled celebration of science and the opening of their new LEED Certified Science Center on Science Day, April 12th, a pre-K through 12 open house April 21st, and the Splash and Dash 5K Run and Youth Triathlon, April 27th. Details for all three events at westtown.edu/april@westtown. Westtown School. Expect a life-size education.
When remembering is as painful as forgetting.
The tone was telling them that it's okay to go out and kill the neighbors. They will be doing a duty that is expected of them.
20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, there's a global village of survivors, a conversation with one Rwandan woman who helps hold them all together. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
People's Light and Theater presents Dear Elizabeth, a lyrical, intimate, and moving portrait of two acclaimed American poets, Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell, played by Rindy Eckert and Ellen McLaughlin. Using her trademark intelligence and whimsy, playwright Sarah Rule breathes life into a relationship that delicately adapts Bishop and Lowell's 30-year correspondence into living poetry on stage. For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times. Bob Mankoff threw me off. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Bob Mankoff about his life, his approach to cartoons, his years at The New Yorker. He is the editor of The New Yorker's Cartoons and also author of a memoir called How About Never Is Never Good For You. Let me get Anne from Ardmore to join our conversation. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm one of those people who has been reading The New Yorker for the 72 years of my life and all my parents' back issues. My very favorite cartoon was drawn, it appeared in an issue somewhere in the early 70s.
Okay.
It shows a long, tall string bean of a man, very rough. I want to say Gayon Wilson, but it's rougher than Gayon Wilson's
pictures. Probably not Gayon. I don't think he was contributing that early to. Yeah.
Okay, so then it was somebody else.
Yeah.
The guy is obviously just home from work in his overalls and his cap, and he puts his lunchbox on the counter, and he says very, I'm imagining pompously, "I heard a bit of good news today."
We go this way,
but once, yes.
It's George Price. It's not
George
Robert.
Price, yes.
Yeah,
thank
it's
you.
George Price, and he is one of the cartoonists who never did any of his ideas.
Oh, interesting.
So, but he had this wonderful, very sharp style.
He's fabulous.
It was sort of like pre-George Bruce. Like, there's no one could draw the back. There would just be these ramshackle groups of people sometimes. And that's unusual, with only two people watching the Brooklyn Dodgers, and there'd be 15 people, grandmothers, kids, dogs. And the thing he drew amazingly well was the back of a television set. It was so intricate, if you remember that. And that's a wonderful cartoon also, because there's something very poignant and philosophical about it. And so it's both, on the face of it, it's sad, but yet it's humorous at the same time. And that's part of the function that humor has for us. It helps us cope. So that's a great cartoon.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do you think there is the sort of, what is a New Yorker cartoon? I mean, is there a definition of a New Yorker cartoon?
If it appears in the pages of The New Yorker.
Well, I understand that, but I'm interested in, and I know that you sit down with David Remnick and others
to make that decision. I think one of the things that defines it is its diversity. It's wide-ranging, where you can have poignant cartoons, you can have absolute straight gags, you can have, the guy talking to the cat in front of the usual litter thing, and he's saying, never ever think outside the box.
Yes, I like that.
You know what I mean? You can have philosophical cartoons, like I have in my book here, a cartoon of mine, in which there's three fish. One fish is thinking, little fish, there is no justice in the world. The middle fish is thinking, there's some justice in the world. The big fish is thinking, the world is just. So the cartoons demand a knowledge from you, a reference from you about things, but also an openness from you to enjoy a James Thurber cartoon, a crazy cartoon by a new cartoonist, he's not crazy, Zach Cannon, where it's called Paninis of the Old West, and it shows a panini on a railroad track, and the villain has it tied. Well, nothing could be more different than that. But that, what The New Yorker is saying is the world of humor is not one thing. Life is not one thing. Life is not just seriousness. One of the things, the cartoons are right there in the magazine next to these serious articles. They give it sort of a parallel universe, a space. So I think all those things are, define the New Yorker cartoon.
There's one I really like, and it says, physicists find elusive particle seen as key to universe, the discovery of the Higgs boson particle, and these two scientists looking at this drawer that someone has pulled out. Always the last place you look.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things humor also does. You take this very highfalutin technical subject, and you reduce it to a human space.
Do your cartoons ever end up in that list of that pile of 50 that then have to get decided on?
Oh, of course.
And do you recuse yourself, or how does that work?
Well, I realize that there's a conflict of interest, and that's why I've created a Blue Ribbon Committee, which I'm heading. To see.
Sounds very suspicious
to
me.
Yeah, very suspicious. Yeah, this whole Chris Christie thing was great for me because it completely deflected. I David Remick decides on my cartoons, and really the truth is, since I become a cartoon editor, I publish fewer cartoons. I'm pretty careful about that. I'm not in the issue most times. My over the years, what's happened is I've shifted much more to, and that's part of what this book about, mentoring a whole new generation of cartoonists. And that's really sort of what I'm interested in. When I get a good idea for a cartoon, I'll show it to David, and he'll say, it isn't a good idea. I said, thank you.
And the Tina Brown years, I mean, when you look at the cartoons there, do they have a kind of Tina Brown signature?
Well, Tina was trying to move the pendulum from sort of the very, very, could be very stuffy cartoons, still great cartoons of William Shawn, but many topics weren't dealt with. You know, the news that people actually have sexual relations somehow did not make it into the New Yorker cartoons. So on the Tina, you know, I have a cartoon in which it's a
lot of breasts, I have breasts, to say, that breasts, you included.
We always had breasts, they just didn't have nipples.
So we can thank Tina Brown for that.
Definitely for the nipples. So she pushed it away, and you know, some people were outraged, as they're always outraged by change. Some people didn't want the New Yorker to change at all, but really, the New Yorker changes, humor changes, you know, everything changes.
Let me get Chris from Frankfurt to join our conversation. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi
can
there.
You hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. Just very quickly, my question. I was a cartoonist of small stature at one time, and one of the questions I had regarding it, sometimes I would come up with a cartoon that was it was rather subtle, and I would show it around, and a lot of people didn't get it. I was wondering if your guest ever had to make a decision on something that maybe a joke that he got and might have even been rather funny, but I had to wonder if it was taking a chance on how many people got it. And I'll give you an example.
Well, you know what, Chris?
Let
me just take your point, only because it's hard sometimes to talk about drawings on the air, but I think you know what he's talking about.
Oh, absolutely. We have a feature in a cartoon issue we've run a number of times called I Don't Get It.
Right.
and there are a lot of different reasons to not get a cartoon. One, you cannot get it because you don't really understand the reference. And sometimes that happens. The other time you cannot get it because there's nothing really to get. It's like a Thurber cartoon. It's something to enjoy. So it's not like a setup and a punchline where everybody's going to get it. Everybody's going to understand the dynamics of the lawyer saying to the client on the phone, my office hours are over, Ms. Davis, but I always have time and a half for you. Okay, people are not going to necessarily get a cartoon of mine in which I have a guy in front of a table and a lot of objects, and the guy is saying, all you need is a pair of Gucci loafers, an ordinary deck of playing cards, and a bicycle pump, and you're ready to begin. There's nothing actually to get.
Right.
It's sort of like Monty Python or something like that. But one of the things that the New Yorker is, we don't intentionally do that, but on the other hand, we're not afraid that someone's not going to get it, and sometimes we like to push the envelope on that.
But you talk about, and even maybe with subtle cartoons, the element of surprise. I mean, that has to be kind of baked into a cartoon.
Well, it's got to be baked into a cartoon in that you have a setup, and the narrative is going to change. The narrative, the cartoon is taking you along a course. Two cavemen, one is saying to the other, I don't understand it. The water is pure. The air is completely clean. Everything we eat is organic, and yet we only live to be 30. So you're almost anticipating something. So humor is the surprise we expect. It's the surprise we expect. We know it's a joke. We know we're going to be surprised. That's the delight. It's like being on a roller coaster. It's somewhat, even though we know it's coming, it's change. But that combination of both knowing it's coming and knowing it's safe in a way, and understanding the surprise is the thing that makes it funny.
I like one of yours, these two women standing at a bar talking to each other. And one of them says, I hate to admit it, but a man with a big carbon footprint makes me hot. Where did you think that up?
It's just people's conflicting attitudes about the environment and stuff like that. I mean, I play off a little bit of associations that would go through your mind there. also, and I think maybe there's some truth to it. We find that there was recently this article, I think, in the Times magazine about men who really help out with women, men who are the gender roles and everything, but they're not having as much sex
That's
as the
right.
people
I remember
who,
that.
People whose gender roles are a little bit more defined.
Let me see what Wade from Hatboro has to say. Wade, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Out of the hundreds, three of my favorites, all from the 70s. One, a fellow standing on a street corner. He's got a trench coat on. He's got his hands in his pocket. He needs a shave, and he's got a rumpled Homburg hat on. And he's standing there sort of morosely next to a little table. And on the little table is a pocket calculator with a little sign that says, square root, 10 cents.
And that's so much.
There's
so much of its time.
Yeah, indeed.
The typical chubby executive on the phone with his cigar, and he's saying on the phone, "I don't care what anybody says. You can keep a good man down.
You can keep a good man down."
And the final one, hallway. A bunch of guys in suits slapping each other's hands above their heads, and two guys with pocket protectors talking to each other. One says to the other, "High fives. Something's up at corporate."
Hey, do you have those on your refrigerator?
As a matter of fact, I was a mechanical designer way back when, and I always had a copy of the first one next to my drawing board.
I
Square
see.
Roots, 10 cents. Although that's a little dated, but still good.
Right. Well, Peter Arno's famous cartoon, actually, like mine, No Thursday's Out, instituted the phrase where it's the engineer is walking back from the crash. The plane has crashed. The pilot's escaped. Everyone's running towards the plane crash, and the designer who's walking away is saying, "Well, back to the old drawing board."
Back to the old drawing board.
That's great, Wade. Thanks for the call.
Have a drawing board upstairs.
Yeah, thanks, Wade.
And that's where that phrase comes from.
You know, I have a New Yorker cartoon above my desk, and it's an interview that's going on, and the interviewer says to the guest, "Your book about puddles is really stupid." Or some version of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, but what's interesting about this election is if you ask 1,000 other people what their three favorite, no one would say that humor is inherently subjective.
Right.
That these things spoke to that person because he was an engineer. You interview things. You have that feeling that, and we don't know names. We don't need to name any names. But sometimes, you might be reading a book on, the entire history of the paperclip and how it changed Western civilization.
I've done that book.
I mean, there seems to be like a whole slew of books recently. How the pencil is changed civilization, how everything, the invention of the sock and all that it led to, and how World War II, led straight from it. So I think so. You related to that, and
indeed.
So at some point, my book you like, but all of a sudden you were in the minutiae of the sock, and what you really wanted to say, your book on the sock
it's
is really,
really
stupid.
I'm going to save that line for the appropriate interview. I was interested, as you wrote about the caption contest, which you have in the New Yorker at the end, that 84% of the people who make submissions are men.
That's right.
84%.
And 16%, therefore, are women. But women win about 22% of the time.
Yeah, but still.
But
interesting.
Well, people cannot set both held a position that there are enormous cultural influences that are different between men and women, and not think there's going to be different outputs from those influences. So I don't think there's any inherent differences in the ability to tell jokes or the ability to be funny. But part of being funny is misbehaving. Like I misbehaved back in the 60s with that teacher. You know what? That would have been very unusual for
a woman to do that.
To do that. To just completely misbehave. Because for the most part, women and girls are taught to be good, and boys are given leeway to be bad. I mean, there's a whole a debate in education now about we're making boys be too good. Part of it is them being free to be boys. That there are some sort of differences. So I think those differences manifest itself in who's willing to risk being bad.
We have a comment from Burke. Is it harder to draw a cartoon without a caption, do you think?
I've always found that much more difficult, that if you set up an incongruous picture, then it almost forces you to come up. So I have a couple on a couch, and they're going over a waterfall, and the woman is saying to the man, "Brad, we've got to talk."
Yes.
But those early cartoons I do in some way, they're not necessarily the funniest, mm-hmm. because they tend to be a little bit more cerebral, a little bit more philosophical. I mean, some cartoons almost have captions inherent with them. It might be a title, or it might be a Great Dana Fraden cartoon in which it shows a scoreboard, like a baseball scoreboard, and shows all the innings where it says realist versus idealist. And the realists are scoring every inning, and zero for the idealist, but the end score, it's the idealist who win. So I do think it's more difficult, although some people, like John O'Brien from The New Yorker, that's their natural mode.
Yeah. So do you feel like you have one of the best jobs there is? I mean, I know it's a lot of hard work, and I don't want to take that away
from you.
You
know what? It's not that much hard work.
Is that true?
Isn't that so terrible?
Don't say that.
It's the best job, and it's even not that much.
It's
work. It's work, and it's pressure, and it's everything. But, you know, it's the best job, because I'm also get to do cartoons. It's a privilege. It's also an incredible privilege, because it's partly due, I think, to some abilities I have. It's mainly due to the New Yorker system going on since 1925.
Yeah, amazing.
This cultural institution with baked in cartoons to part of it. So, yeah, it's a great job. And also, as I said, I'm inept at anything else, so I'm really lucky.
It all worked out for
it
you,
all
didn't
worked
it?
Out, yeah. That whole being a fireman thing, even though I said it when I was 4, dressed up and everything, carrying those heavy things, running into fires, don't want to do it.
Well, Bob Mankoff, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's the cartoon editor at The New Yorker Effect, a job that he's had since 1997. And his new book, a memoir called How About Never Is Never Good For You, My Life in Cartoons. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter and podcasts. And you can also hear us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, with help from Adam Staniszewski. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.